All right, with that, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your primary presenter today. And Emmy, I think we're going to do a quick recap here of the ongoing series before we jump right into today's content, correct?
Yes, let's go ahead and do that. So thank you everyone for joining us today. Really quick before we get started with today's content, we want to give a small commercial to our Federal Facilities Academy. So the Academy is a voluntary training program that was developed for EPA RPMs, as well as project managers from other federal agencies, state government, and tribal groups who work on federal facilities Superfund cleanups. We are in the middle of that series. We offer these every 2 years, so 2024. Next will be in 2026, to update our webinars regarding guidance or new policies, new regs that have come out. So if you complete all of the 11 webinars plus the in-person 3-day classroom training, you are eligible to receive a certificate of completion. And I'm going to hand it back over to Jean to give the specifics on how to show that you've completed all of the courses.
All right, thank you, Emmy. So just a gentle reminder, this entire series is composed of 11 online webinars that we're hosting through Kluin, which are open to the public, and that one classroom delivery, which is open to a limited or restricted audience. As far as the 11 online webinars, you can participate in any or all of them live online, just as we're doing today, or by replaying the recorded or archived versions. You can do any combination of those. For that in-person classroom delivery, you will need to be part of the targeted audience, either EPA, state, tribal, or other federal agency representative, and you must attend that delivery in person. To document your participation when you attend the webinars, either live online or replay the recorded versions, you'll need to submit the feedback form for those sessions and check the box to verify you either attended live or replayed the entire session. And then once you submit that feedback form, you'll immediately have a certificate for that individual session. So you can document and get participation verification for any and all of the webinars, regardless of how you attend. And then for that in-person classroom delivery, if you complete the entire webinar series, again, mixing and matching any combination of live, online, or replaying the recorded, and then attending that in-person delivery in person, you will then receive the Academy certificate, which indicates you completed the entire suite of courses in the Federal Facilities Academy. So with that, Emmy, I think we're ready to transition over to the presentation material. Let me call up those slides and I will turn the floor over to you.
All right, thank you so much, Jean. So for today's webinar, we are looking at ARARs, the applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, and how they're determined at our federal facility sites. So overall, I guess before we get into the content, I just want to check in with the group to see which ARARs do you believe are most cited in federal facility decision documents.
All right, so at this time, there is a new window that should have popped open on your screen. It's a short answer style question asking which ARARs do you believe are most cited in a federal facility decision document? You should see a small box below that where you can type in your response, and then at the bottom of that window, hit submit. If you do not see that pop-up window, you can always share your response in the Q&A. We'll give you just a few more seconds to share your responses here, and then I'll close the poll and we'll talk a little bit about the responses that we're seeing. So again, just a quick summary. There's no right or wrong. We're just trying to get a pulse for the audience here today. And as I'm scrolling through here in the responses, just checking to see if anything came in through the Q&A. I see about 50 of you have shared your responses here through that poll window. So I'm going to close that poll here in 3, 2, 1. And then we're going to take a quick look at those responses. So as I call those up here on the screen, I'm going to load this here and we will talk through those responses that came in. And I want to thank everybody for sharing your responses on this one. So Emmy, as I'm scrolling through, I'm seeing everything from the Clean Water Act, Endangered Species. Definitely 13304 seems to be a commonly cited one, MCLs. RCRA, again, Clean Water, the Endangered Species Act. Those are certainly the top ones, but we also have some people who have submitted responses that I'm so new to this, I'm not even sure how to discern the different ARARs that I've seen. So I need help even categorizing them. So definitely it looks like MCLs and that Clean Water Act and then Endangered Species are the most common ones.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for answering that poll. Just gives a better idea of the range of folks that we have on today's webinar. So let's go ahead and jump into the content now. So we'll be talking about ARARs, their definition, what that means, as well as TBCs to be considered. We'll talk about different types of ARARs and their substantive and administrative requirements, how that applies in our federal facility cleanups. Then we'll get more into the how-to with how to document ARARs, how to identify ARARs and analyze them for your decision documents. And we'll finish it all up with a discussion on CERCLA ARAR waivers. There are three pieces of guidance that I wanted to highlight that were the basis of this webinar. Two of them are fairly old, but are still cited. It's the interim final guidance on CERCLA compliance with other laws manual, part one and two. A lot of this information came from there, but we also have more recent guidance from 2023 that is citing what we had in the manuals, as well as just providing some clarification and templates that might be easier to use. And that 2023 guidance is available on the course information website, so you can go ahead and download that and have it available. So let's go ahead and start with looking at ARARs. So why do we need to even know what an ARAR is? Why is it necessary? Well, going back a little bit with CERCLA, which was enacted to address abandoned, uncontrolled, and hazardous waste sites, we had to determine, well, how do we do this in a protective fashion? Another thing to keep in mind, and we'll talk more about this later, is when it comes to permits, permits are not required for on-site work under CERCLA. So how do you make sure that the appropriate requirements are being met to be protective within the remedy? I also want to identify that it was Congress's intent to streamline and expedite the cleanup at our CERCLA sites, our Superfund sites. So, how do we go about doing that in a streamlined fashion? They still want CERCLA cleanups to achieve those applicable standards to ensure that our remedies are protective, meaning that they're protective of human health and the environment. So, essentially, it comes down to protectiveness. That's why ARARs are necessary. As I just mentioned, any on-site activities for CERCLA cleanups must either attain the ARAR or waive it. And we'll talk all about waivers at the end of today's session. But ARAR should be complied with during implementation of the remedial actions that are selected. If you look at CERCLA Section 121D, which requires that on-site remedial actions attain or waive federal environmental laws or more stringent state environmental or facility siting laws that are determined to be ARARs, that's essentially what's going to be identified in that final decision or cleanup document. Under some limited circumstances, local requirements may be ARARs as well, but that is typically fairly rare. To elaborate more on state requirements, CERCLA requires that Superfund remedial actions comply with state environmental or facility siting laws, provided these three conditions. The first is that they are promulgated. So that means that the requirement is of general applicability and are legally enforceable. So that's important. That's what you, it has to be promulgated if it's going to be an ARAR. Also, with state requirements, they should be or must be more stringent than federal laws, and they should be identified by the state in the CERCLA process in a timely manner. So it's not something that would be brought up at the 11th hour when we're trying to sign a decision document. This should happen earlier in the CERCLA process, to ensure that the right conversations are happening. Just checking, Jean, can you hear me okay?
Sorry, yes, I can. You're coming through loud and clear.
Okay, apologies, having some issue with my video, but we'll continue on. So we've talked a bit about ARARs. We'll talk much more about it, but I want to pause for a second and talk about TBCs, or these are to be considered requirements. So non-promulgated advisories are guidance that are issued by federal or state government. Again, non-promulgated is the key word there, meaning they're not legally enforceable. So TBCs will be considered along with ARARs during that site risk assessment and when determining necessary levels of cleanup. So one thing to keep in mind with TVCs, that those are not items that you would just throw in a record of decision and saying, ah, well, maybe we'll think about it, maybe we won't. No, essentially, if you have a TVC that's included in the ROD, it's because they're necessary to interpret ARARs or determine preliminary remediation goals. So once a TVC is in a record of decision, they are essentially treated like an ARAR. So keep that in mind when making your ARAR tables that TBCs should only be included if they are necessary to interpret ARARs for that decision. So let's talk a little bit about how do we identify ARARs? Where do we even begin? So with identification of ARARs, there's a site-specific approach involving a two-part analysis. You're asking yourself two questions. First, is this requirement applicable, which has its own definition, or is it relevant and appropriate? Keep in mind that a requirement can be either applicable or relevant and appropriate, but it can't be both. It's either or. And these are going to be based on the circumstances of the site. So let's look at that a little more closely. With applicable requirements, they are promulgated under federal or state law, and they are specifically addressing a hazardous substance, pollutant, contaminant, remedial action, location, or other circumstance at a CERCLA site. Again, identifying what those ARARs are important, and the lead and support agency should be working together to identify those applicable requirements, be it to the release of contamination or to the remedial action itself. So let's look at the second part of this, relevant and appropriate requirements. What does that even actually mean? So when you're addressing situations that are sufficiently similar to the circumstances of the release or remedial action that's being considered at a site, then this might be a well-suited requirement to consider. It could be promulgated cleanup standards, standards of control, other substantive environmental protection requirements and criteria that are not applicable. So they're not, I think of applicable as directly, like it's apples to apples. You can definitely easily identify why it's applicable, directly applicable, but with relevant and appropriate, there's a lot of professional judgment that comes into play there. One example that I think helps to make it really clear is say you have a groundwater cleanup, and this groundwater has been identified as a potential source of drinking water, but you're not actually pumping the water right now for drinking. If that is a potential source of drinking water, then maximum contaminant levels or MCLs may not be applicable. It's not directly applicable because no one is drinking that water right now. It's not water coming out of a tap, so to speak, but it could be pumped and used for drinking water in the future. So it would MCLs would be generally considered relevant and appropriate. I hope that example helps. That really helped me understand the difference between the two. I'm hoping that it's helpful for you all as well. One other example I can think of is when it comes to you have a federal facility site that has radiological contamination, you might be looking at contaminants like uranium or thorium. So there are requirements for uranium and thorium processing facilities that could be considered as relevant and appropriate, even if at that site there was no such processing conducted. But because of the type of contamination that's being looked at, the contaminants of uranium and thorium, again, it might be generally considered relevant and appropriate to consider those requirements. So, a few examples there. So, continuing on with how do we figure this out then? That determination that a requirement is relevant and appropriate considers both. Is it relevant and appropriate? It can't just be relevant and not appropriate, and vice versa. So you might be asking yourself, well, what does that even mean? What is relevant versus appropriate? How do I figure that out? Well, there is a specific list of requirements, or I should say factors, that should be considered when trying to determine if a requirement is relevant and appropriate. And again, this is largely based on professional judgment. So here is a list of those 8 site-specific comparisons to help determine whether a requirement is relevant and appropriate. On the left-hand side, we have characteristics of the requirement, and you're going to compare that to the characteristics of the CERCLA site circumstances or action that you're dealing with. So you look at the purpose of the requirement and the purpose of the action, what medium is involved, the substances involved, or activities that are being considered. You'll also want to look at any waivers, exemptions, or variances that can apply in this situation. And look at the type of place that's regulated. Also, if you're dealing with facilities, the type and size of structure that's being regulated, and any consideration of the use of potential use of affected resources after cleanup. So with the, it's very, I mean, there's a lot of information to consider here, a lot of site-specific comparisons that can be made that will help you determine, okay, is this really relevant and appropriate? So don't feel like you just have to guess at it. There actually is a lot of information provided for you to consider in making that determination. All right, so we're going to pause for a second, and Jean's going to take us through this question. Oh, Jean, I think you're on mute. Unless it's just me, I can't hear you. Can others hear Jean?
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Wonderful. Sorry about that. All right, so there is a new poll window that has opened up asking the following question. Which of the following is not true of a TBC? Is it A, it is promulgated, B, it is not promulgated, C, it is considered in determining a remedy's protectiveness, or D, it can help determine preliminary remediation goals? You'll see a circle to the left of each response in that poll window. Simply click the circle next to the answer, which you think is the not true statement, and then hit the submit button. If you have any difficulties with that online poll window, if you don't see it, look for a three dot or more menu somewhere in Zoom. You may need to manually launch the poll. And then if that still doesn't work for you, you can always simply type your response into the Q&A. All right, Emmy, it looks like about two-thirds of the audience have cast their vote. So I'll give them just a few more seconds here to send in their answers. And then I'll go ahead and close this poll in 3, 2, 1. All right, with 3/4 of you having voted, let's look at those results. So about half of the audience said it's A, it is promulgated, but almost a third said it's not promulgated. Emmy, what's the right answer?
So the question again is which of the following is not true of a TBC? So the answer we were looking for is A, that it is promulgated because TBCs are not promulgated. So sorry if the phrasing caught people off guard on that one. But we were looking for A as the answer. All right. Oh, we actually have one more question to
We
ask you
do.
all.
All right, so let's launch this very next one. So our next question is in reference to Site Y. Site Y identifies a facility that was used for plutonium processing and is radiologically contaminated. Remediation will address contaminated buildings and soil. So considering that particular site, we ask which of the following standards could be considered relevant and appropriate for this remedial action. This particular question will allow you to select all that apply. So you'll see a square to the left of each answer, and you can check multiple or just pick one, whatever you think is correct. So your options are A, RCRA closure and post-closure performance standards for a waste management unit, B, RCRA requirements for tank systems, including response to leaks or spills, C, standards for cleanup of other radiologically contaminated sites, such as uranium and thorium processing facilities, or D, Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulations for low-level waste transfer and disposal. So take your best guess, checking off all that you think are relevant and appropriate for this particular site, and then hit the submit button. If for any reason you can't read them all in the poll window, that's exactly why we show them there on the screen in the slides. You can adjust the poll window off to the side, read the full responses, and then pick the appropriate A, B, C, or D from that poll pop-up. And do not worry, we are not going to grade you. So just do your very best guess, and we will go ahead and close this poll here. Ooh, look at those answers coming in. All right, in 3, 2, 1. All right, let me close it now. Let's look at those results. About 70% of you responded, and it looks like 82% of the audience thought C was relevant and appropriate. And then about 70% also thought D, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulations, were both relevant and appropriate. And then about half of you said A, and just over a quarter said B.
All right. So for that question, we were looking for the answers of C and D as being relevant and appropriate for this example. Now, I realize there's not a lot of details provided. So, as far as choosing A or B, there probably could be an argument made that, oh, yes, that these would also be relevant and appropriate under these circumstances. Totally understand that it's a very simple scenario that we're provided. But in this case, again, we were looking for C and D as the answers. All right. Before we get into types of AERARs, do we have any questions from the audience, Jean?
All right, Emmy, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Beautiful. We did have just a few questions that have come in. One of them I think we can address right away. And this question is asking, are relevant and appropriate requirements enforceable?
Yes, AERARs, including those relevant and appropriate requirements identified, need to be legally enforceable to be considered as an AERAR. So, yes.
Okay. And how about in the CERCLA process? Exactly when are you identifying and selecting your AERARs?
We're going to talk a little bit about that in the next slide, but you
Okay.
essentially are considering AERARs throughout the entire CERCLA process.
Okay. All right. And we have some other more site-specific questions that I see sitting in the queue. So we're going to hold those ones to later, depending on timing, see if we can roll those up into a broader set. So right now, Emmy, just in the interest of time, it's about 1:28. Let's carry on with the presentation.
All right. So now we're going to get into the different types of AERARs. The question we had just now is, well, when do you start considering them? Well, when it comes to chemical specific and location specific AERARs, you're going to start looking at those pretty early during your site investigation. So chemical specific AERARs are those requirements that are usually health or risk-based numerical values or methodologies used to determine an acceptable concentration of a chemical that might be found in or discharged to the environment, MCLs, for example. With location-specific AERARs, these requirements restrict actions or contaminant concentrations in certain environmentally sensitive areas. So they're locate it's it deals with a specific place, a specific location, hence the name. These two types of AERARs you can start considering very early on in your cleanup as you better understand the contaminants you're dealing with at the site and the characteristics of the site you're at. Is it in a floodplain? Is it in some other type of environmentally sensitive area? Or is it a location that has been used industrially for decades and doesn't have a lot of sensitive areas? All things to consider. When it comes to action-specific AERARs, which are usually technology or activity-based requirements or limitations on actions that are specific to conditions and specific substances, those are identified during your feasibility study because during your FS, you're looking at alternatives for cleanup that could be implemented at the site. So those actions that are being contemplated will have AERARs associated with them. So again, you're basically considering AERARs once you start your CERCLA process at the site, and they get refined throughout the process. So let's look a little bit more closely at each of these categories of AERARs. With your chemical specific AERAR, again, you're looking at that health or risk-based numerical value or methodology. And the resulting values is the establishment of numerical values that are applied to site-specific conditions. And these values will establish the acceptable amount or concentration of a chemical that can be found or discharged to the environment. And I had mentioned the numerical MCLs for groundwater that is identified as a potential source of drinking water is one clear example. So when you we're going to talk a little bit more about how to document ARARs in a rod, but I just wanted to start introducing that to you all here. So this is from a 2014 rod that shows the chemical specific ARAR. You'll note in the top left-hand corner, table C1, it specifically states these are chemical specific ARARs. We're dealing with groundwater here. It provides the citation that this is coming from the Safe Drinking Water Act. And then for the ARAR determination, it's identified as relevant and appropriate. Note that in 2014, we didn't have very clear or detailed guidance on how to document ARARs in a record of decision. The 2023 guidance that I mentioned earlier does have templates that you can look at. And this, well, sorry, here it's just another example from the same 2014 rod, again, that identifies the specific requirement. This one you can see is a state requirement. And for ARAR determination, it's actually identified as a TBC, a to be considered. So in this case, it likely is something that was not promulgated, but is to be considered with the other requirements for the rod. What I wanted to show here is a ARARS table that is more in line with what the 2023 guidance suggests you should have in your records of decision. Again, this is a suggested template. It's not necessarily required to be exactly like this, but if you're unsure how to capture these ARARS, this is a great template to follow. So it has the media or action being considered, the requirement, the prerequisite to that requirement, and then the specific citation. So again, for more details on what these tables should look like, check out that 2023 guidance. All right, with action-specific requirements, remember these are technology or activity-based requirements or limitations, and they're basically telling or when it comes to your remedial alternative, these ARARs are saying how it must be achieved to ensure that things are done in a protective manner. So some example are requirements that would be related to parts of a remedy that include air stripping or capping or injection of treated groundwater. There'll be very specific federal and likely state requirements that need to be followed with each of those actions. So again, we have an example from that 2014 rod for the action-specific ARARs. Here, the requirement is looking at effluent requirements for discharges to surface water. That's the requirement. It's a federal requirement. The citation is very specific. As you can see, it gets into the details, and that's what you want. You don't want to just cite the Clean Water Act as an ABAR because there's a lot in there. So you try and get down to be as specific as possible as to what is included as an ABAR in your decision. And here, that you can see the ARAR determination was that it was applicable. And then there were additional comments to help provide background. There's another example of an ARAR table that shows an action-specific ARAR for activities causing fugitive dust emissions. So you can see the requirement is spelled out there. The prerequisite about fugitive emissions from land disturbing activities is identified there, and it's identified as an applicable requirement along with the citation. And lastly, with location-specific requirements, again, these are restrictions placed on the concentration of hazardous substances or the conduct of activities at a site solely because they occur in a special location. So these location-specific requirements may include narrative requirements rather than specifying a cleanup number. When it comes to these type of requirements, consultation with other agencies as necessary will help ensure compliance with ARARs. So do you have to work with the Fish and Wildlife Service, or are there other agencies that can ensure that these location-specific requirements are being met? So reaching out to those agencies and involving them in the conversation is important. So some locations that are sensitive and have specific requirements are floodplains, wetlands, historic places, sensitive ecosystems, or habitats. So in those cases, there are going to be additional requirements, again, based solely on where they occur in that special location. From our 2014 rod example, We have our location-specific ARAR. The requirement here is the Endangered Species Act, which is a federal requirement identified as applicable because there is a critical habitats upon which an endangered species depends that are being impacted by, or potentially impacted by this remedy. And we also have our 2020 example with the location-specific ARARs and TBCs. This one, starting off here, is looking at the presence of wetlands and then the presence of floodplains, gets into the requirements there, the prerequisite. You'll see the first one listed here is actually a TBC, a to be considered, and it's being taken from an executive order. All right, hopefully those examples help you understand how you might identify ARARs in your decision documents as you're moving forward. So, to speak a little bit more specifically on determining ARARs for a federal facility, some things to keep in mind are that it's going to be a team effort, a combined effort by the federal facility agreement parties, your FFA parties, and it's going to occur throughout the entire CERCLA process. So, your lead cleanup agency, EPA, the state regulatory agency will be working together to identify what the ARARs are throughout the entire process. So, identifying ARARs are pertinent to the characteristics of the site, the substances that are present, and the potential remedial actions will take place throughout. And keep in mind that EPA cannot specify, we don't have an answer sheet where we could specify in advance what the requirements for ARARs will be for a site. It is something that needs to be discussed and worked upon by all the parties involved to ensure that we have all the appropriate requirements, be it federal or state requirements, included in that ultimate record of decision to ensure that our remedy is protective and meets all of these requirements. All right, we're going to pause for a second with another a question for the audience.
All right, here I am launching the poll. So, a new question has popped up on your screen where we're asking you to consider the following scenario. You are considering an in-situ groundwater remediation approach for your site. How would you label the state's water policy that the groundwater is considered a potential source of drinking water? Is it A, a TBC? Is it B, applicable? Is it C, relevant and appropriate? Or is it D, none of the above? So this is a single choice. You click the circle to the left of what you think is the correct answer on how you might label that state's water policy, and then you'll hit the submit button. It looks like about a third of you have cast your response, but again, if you have any difficulties with those polls on the screen, you can always share a message in the chat or in the Q&A and just let us know how you would be voting in this poll. All right, it seems like there's getting growing consensus around one answer. So, with about two-thirds of you having cast your vote, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll down in 3, 2, 1. All right, so Emmy, it looks like about half of the audience thought the correct answer was C, relevant and appropriate.
All right, so for this question, we were actually looking for the answer of A to be considered. So here in this scenario, the state's water policy, it's presented as a policy, so it likely is not promulgated. So maybe that was a bit too much hidden information, but the water policy was supposed to be the key word for people to assume, oh, this isn't promulgated. If it's not promulgated, meaning it's not legally enforceable, then it cannot be an ARAR. So the TBCs are non-promulgated advisories or guidance that are issued by a federal or state government that are not legally binding and don't have the status of being a potential ARAR. So in this case, because it's a policy that we're assuming was not promulgated because it's being referred to as a policy, we were looking for the status of to be considered because it is really likely important to be considered as part of the remedy, but since it's not promulgated, we can identify it as an ARAR, but it can be considered in implementation of the remedy and development of cleanup levels and standards. Okay. Let's go ahead and get into substantive and administrative requirements of ARARs. So I've mentioned a few times that for on-site activities, for a CERCLA cleanup action, you don't need a permit, right? So requirements that pertain directly to actions or conditions for on-site activities could include things like quantitative health or risk-based restrictions, depending on exposure to types of hazardous substances. For we've used the MCL example quite a bit. So that's one type. The technology-based requirements for actions taken upon a hazardous substance could be things like incineration or incinerator standards that are going to require particular destruction and removal efficiencies, or restrictions upon activities in special locations, for example, floodplains or wetlands, requirements that are going to pertain directly to those actions or conditions. Oh, let me come back to that slide for a second. So, with these examples, we're looking at substantive requirements. These are all types of chemical, action-based, location-based requirements that are substantive. So, for that on-site CERCLA action, these requirements need to be met. But now let's look at our administrative requirements. Administrative requirements are looking at mechanisms that facilitate the implementation of substantive requirements of a statute or regulation. So it can include things like the approval of or consultation with administrative bodies, the issuance of a permit, reporting, housekeeping, or record keeping, I should say, things like that. So they're prescribing methods and procedures by which substantive requirements are made effective. So this part, if you want to think about it as the paperwork part, although it can be more than that, are not don't have to be met on site for CERCLA actions. The substantive requirements do. That's going to affect protectiveness, but these administrative requirements are not treated the same as the substantive requirements. So these don't have to be met. However, I should say, if there's an activity that occurs offsite, then those activities must meet both the substantive and administrative requirements of applicable laws and regulations. They don't fall under that on-site CERCLA action umbrella. Coming back to when you might need to phone a friend, so to speak, or reach out for help by consulting with other agencies, it's important that be either the lead cleanup agency or the regulators as needed. Should consult with these administrating agencies to ensure that the remedial activities being implemented comply with substantive ARARs. So, looking for these agencies that understand the National Historic Preservation Act, the Archaeological and Historic Preservation Act, ESA, Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, all of these will be important to understand. You want to make sure that your record of decision has covered these appropriately. So it may require that you reach out to other agencies to make sure that you understand the requirements and that all applicable ones, or I should say ARARs, have been included. Don't assume that your agency has expertise on that. If you can consult with another agency that absolutely does have expertise, why not do that? Why not just ensure that your AVARs are as specific and as accurate as possible? All right. So we're going to pause for a second to take a closer look at substantive requirements.
All right, let's launch that poll. So again, we've got a new pop-up on the screen asking you to consider which of the following are the substantive requirements. In this case, you can select all that apply. Is it A, consultation with administrative bodies, technology-based requirements, that's option B, C, restrictions on activities in a floodplain, option D is record-keeping processes, and then last option E, issuance of a permit. You can check the box next to any and all answers that you think are correct and then hit the submit button. Any technical issues, go ahead and use that Q&A spot or Q&A pop-up to share your responses. And I'm scrolling through here to make sure that we don't have anything else coming in. About half of you have responded. So again, it might be one of these, it might be all of these, any combination of these. Which ones do you think are these types of substantive requirements? Okay, I think I've given you enough time. Let me go ahead and close this poll down in 3, 2, 1, and looking at those results. Looks like the top two were option B and C, technology-based requirements and restrictions on activities in a floodplain. Emmy, how'd they do?
Yes, those were the answers we were looking for, B and C, being the substantive requirements. Remember, consultation with an administrative body is considered an administrative requirement, as well as record keeping and issuing of a permit. You still have to meet the substantive portions of what would be in a permit, but in this case, we were looking for the answers B and C. So good job on that one, everybody. All right. So now we're getting to documenting ARARs. How do we ensure or show our work, so to speak, when it comes to our cleanup decisions? So with AWAR documentation, keep in mind that the record of decision should document ARARs by the major ARARs that should be discussed in the description of alternatives. AWAR compliance should be summarized in the summary of the comparative analysis that occurs in the ROD. And also, all ARARs selected for the remedy should be listed and briefly described in the statutory determination section. So that's how it's going to be documented in that record of decision. What about removal actions? We often get questions of, well, how do I treat ARARs when it comes to removal actions? So the NCP states that removal actions must comply with ARARs to the extent practicable, considering the ex I don't know how to say that word, the circumstances of the situation. So, what does that mean? Practicable. How do we even determine what that is? So, in determining whether compliance with an ARAR is applicable or practicable, excuse me, the lead agency may consider the urgency of the situation and the scope of the removal action. So, I put some definitions on here as far as trying to understand what practicable means. So, possible implies a thing that may exist given the proper conditions. Okay, practicable states, or according to the dictionary, is capable of being put into practice, implies it is affected by current conditions. Okay, that makes sense. If something is on fire, we are going to have to react to that swiftly, versus if there's a different situation that's being contemplated for a removal action, but maybe has more than 6 months before it needs to be addressed, that's going to be a different set of circumstances. And then we have feasible, which I like to include here because we often take a closer look at that word, is capable of being done or carried out, applies to what is likely to work and attain the desired result. Keyword being attain the desired result for that. So for removal actions, again, ARARs are considered to the extent practicable. And really understanding what that means for the removal action being considered will likely take a conversation again between all the parties involved. It's unfortunately, it's not black and white. It's not one size fits all when it comes to ARARs. So again, what's the point of all this? Why do we look at ARARs? Because we want to develop protective remedies, essentially. So, CERCLA Section 121 requires that selection of a remedial action be protective of human health, of the environment, and meet ARARs or waive an ARAR as needed. So, with EPA's approach to determine protectiveness, there are a couple of steps that are going to be taken. The risk assessment to determine where that risk is, identifying the ARARs, and again, TBCs as appropriate will also need to be identified. So, based on that approach, we'll end up with acceptable exposure levels as well that will help us understand if a remedy is protective or not. The next big question, you're identifying ARARs, be them applicable or relevant and appropriate, or TBCs that are not promulgated. But another big question is when and where should those ARARs be attained? So it's EPA's policy to attain ARARs and necessary TBCs pertaining either to contaminant levels or to performance or design standards to ensure protection at all points of potential exposure. At each potential point of exposure, we use a reasonable maximum exposure scenario. At least we assume one, and then that helps set cleanup goals accordingly to ensure protectiveness under that scenario and also using best professional judgment. So exposure points are going to be very different if you're looking at a commercial or industrial use for a site versus residential use, because it's a difference of people working at a site versus living at a site and all the other exposure pathways that may exist. So that when and where ARUR should be attained, it is also a very big discussion. So when we're looking at exposure point concentrations, here we're looking at some different media and what the exposure point would be considered. So for example, with groundwater, remediation levels should generally be attained throughout the plume, that contaminated plume, or at and beyond the edge of the waste management area when waste is left in place. For surface waters, you're looking at selected levels should be attained at the point or points, there's multiple discharge points, where the release enters the surface waters. And for air, the selected levels should be established for that maximum exposed individual, considering reasonably expected use of the site and the surrounding area. And with the assumptions with these exposure points, again, is that reasonable maximum exposure scenario? You might hear it, this RME scenario is assumed at each potential exposure point. And we're going to talk a little bit more about each of those as points of compliance in a second. So now, I'm going to pause for a second just to see if we have any questions before getting into identification and analysis of ARARs.
Sure. We did have a few quick questions. So does EPA always perform an agency to agency consultation for those location-specific ARARs? Their second part to that question, they wonder, do PRP consultants or federal facilities personnel sometimes do the consultation?
So I would, as far as does this always happen? Does EPA require that this always happen at every Superfund site? I would say there isn't a requirement that that happen. It really depends on the circumstances of your site and the cleanup being considered as to whether that is an appropriate step to take as far as consulting with other agencies that are not part either the PRP or the federal facility involved with the cleanup.
Okay. And are location ARARs the same or similar as LUCs, LUC?
So, LUCs are land use controls, and in a record of decision, your land use controls are identified separately and apart from your ARARs. So, remember, ARARs are those legally enforceable requirements that have been promulgated, and so that is identified in one section. And then, with your land use controls, those could be different requirements, not identified in a legal requirement at all, but it might. You know, notification to EPA if the land is sold or if a lease is considered, et cetera. They are two different things, but through the rod are enforceable.
Okay. Are local building codes ever considered action-specific ARARs?
You know, I am not sure on that one. I would say that's a highly site specific. I don't believe building codes are typically considered as ARARs, assuming that those building codes are not promulgated and legally enforceable. So I don't believe so, but I'm not sure.
Okay. How about state-derived risk-based numerical values? Would those be applied as an ARAR at a federal facility site?
So when it comes to determining cleanup levels, EPA does have guidance on that as well. So we would want to ensure that your state and federal regulatory agencies are working together to ensure that there is an agreed upon process for determining risk. I can't say that automatically the state's approach would be required because it might be that the approach is considered an administrative requirement versus a substantive one and may not necessarily be automatically considered above the federal standards if it's more stringent. So that is a maybe. And I know that's a gray
Okay.
answer, apologies, but it depends on the site.
Sure. All right. I think in the interest of time, let's carry on with the presentation. It's about 1:55 p.m. Eastern, but I will encourage the audience, keep those questions coming in, and we'll pause again shortly for another Q&A break.
Perfect, thank you. All right, so if you're still feeling like, how am I ever gonna do this? I still don't understand ARARs. I don't even know where to start. Here are some questions to help you get started on identifying AERARs. So some questions you can ask yourself about the remedies or alternatives being considered are, does the remedy restore groundwater or clean up contaminated soils? That's one question. Or is the remedy performed in situ or ex situ with the treatment system? So in that case, you would look at RCRA air emission standards would likely apply. For the first example, sorry, my little box didn't pop up. The groundwater related one, it might be that you have to look at the Safe Drinking Water Act primary drinking water standards, right? For groundwater restoration. And as far as contaminated soils, if those are leaching to groundwater, then again, you're going to have want to consider those standards. Going to our third example here, is there a discharge into surface water or emission into air from a treatment system? If so, then you're going to want to look at the Clean Water Act, the substantive portions of a permit that would be captured under the National Disposal. Oh, goodness. I lost it for a second. Sorry. NDPESY. Okay. Apologies. My acronym brain is a little slow today, but also you want to look at the Clean Air Act and NESHAPs as far as, oh, maybe these are AERARs that I need to include in my AERAR table because we do have a discharge to surface water or to air that has to be considered. And another question is the operable unit or site that's being considered, is it located within a floodplain, wetland, or critical habitat or other special location? If so, you're going to want to look at either NEPA or the Clean Water Act Section 404 for those floodplains and wetlands to see some of those AERARs that are going to apply to your alternative or remedy, I should say. And these are not end-alls, right? These are starting points, but questions to help you start to understand what applies here. For federal facility records of decisions, I will say that often there might be a similar record of decision with an AERAR table that you may want to pull from, and that can also be another good starting point. However, remember, copy and paste is not the ultimate answer. You want to make sure that you're going through the specific conditions for the remedy that's you're considering for your site and the site specific circumstances. The land use might be different, the geography might be, or geology may be different. So copy paste from a previous record of decision is not recommended. But as far as some other questions to help you identify AERARs, and I think this one comes up a lot when it's RCRA hazardous and solid waste amendments, if you have an action that generates waste or leaves waste in place, for example, a landfill closure. If you are dealing with remediation waste and secondary waste that is generated, again, RCRA requirements are going to apply. And also, how is the waste being managed? Is it staged, treated, capped, transported, et cetera? All of those are going to lead to different AERARs that'll have to be included in your record of decision. Coming back to this coordination or consultation with other federal and state programs, when we're looking at sources of potential AERARs, be it environmental laws administered by EPA, authorized state programs, for example, those states that have their own RCRA program, other federal agency administered laws, or in the case when you have stringent state environmental or facility siting laws that are more stringent than federal standards, those are opportunities to either coordinate or consultate with other programs. And again, this will help ensure that the remedies are complying with the substantive aspects of the AERARs that are identified. And you're getting that, again, phone a friend, extra support to ensure that you're not missing anything in your record of decision. With chemical-specific AERARs, again, I had asked earlier at the beginning of this, which are some of the most commonly referenced or cited AERARs that we see in decision documents. I would say this is a good list as far as AERARs to consider: Safe Drinking Water Act, MCLs. Those are cited very often, and then the Clean Water Act, water quality criteria, for surface water, if you're discharging to surface water, or that's going to be really important as well. With action-specific ARRs, what we see a lot of are closure requirements for Title or Subtitle C and D landfills, Clean Water Act requirements for point source discharges and stormwater, and Clean Air Act NESHAPs for hazardous air pollutants, asbestos, and radionuclides. So we see these very often in the decision documents for federal facilities. And you, again, looking at the actions that trigger these type of ARRs, it makes sense. Airstripping may commonly be part of a remedy. Capping, you're leaving waste in place. A discharge of a treatment system effluent, dredging, excavation, and so on. All of those are going to trigger responding ARRs. And then with location-specific ARRs, what we see a lot of are the National Historic Preservation Act, for sure, and Endangered Species Act, I would say, are what it. I'm sure there's others as well, but we definitely see those two very much in decision documents. All right. So, having gone through all of that information, let's take a little opportunity to apply your understanding.
Okay, I'm about to launch a poll, but you may need to move that poll window around to fully observe this slide. In this case, we're providing an illustration of a particular site, and we're going to ask you to consider of the areas that are labeled with the yellow circles. You'll see them labeled alphabetically, starting in the lower left, near that well screen A, up toward the top middle, B with the holding tank, then over to the right, we see the treatment train components, D down to C for one of those reinjection wells, and then heading over to the right where we're discharging to surface water. We just want to see where would action-specific AWARs apply in this pump and treat scenario. You can select all that apply, so A, B, C, D, or E. So you'll have boxes to the left of each response. You can check any and all that apply, and then hit that submit button. Where would those action-specific AWARs apply in this particular scenario? We have some trends starting to emerge, and only a third of you have voted. So again, move the poll window around. Do your best if you have to take a guess. If you have any issues, you can always type in a message into the Q&A. I'll give you all just a few more seconds here to consider, and then go ahead and put those responses in so that we can talk through the results. All right, so I'm going to close the poll in 3, 2, 1. All right, 70% of you voted, and let's look at that. So, Emmy, it looks like about 80% of the audience picked E, where we were discharging to the surface water. And then about 70% picked D, those treatment train components. And then almost 70% also picked C, which is that reinjection well, where they thought that there would be action-specific ARRs. So the top three were C, D, and E. What's the right answer?
So we were looking for C, D, and E. So that's great, from our audience pitching in there as far as what action-specific ARRs would apply. And remember, action-specific ARRs are usually technology or activity-based requirements, which is why C, D, and E, were the answers that we were looking for in this case. All right, let's go ahead and go continue on. And then we'll pause for questions in after this next section. All right. So with the general procedure for identification and analysis of ARRs, there's 5 steps. You want to identify your potential ARRs. From there, determine if they're applicable. If not, determine if they're relevant and appropriate. Then identify any TBCs in addition to ARRs. And lastly, determine whether an ARR waiver is justified. So easy peasy, right? No, I joke, because it isn't necessarily that easy. What I'd like to do on this next slide is take you through the different steps on the general procedures for determining if a requirement is applicable. So we went over them on the previous slide, but here we're going to get into a little bit more detail. So your first step is to identify those pertinent facts concerning the circumstances at your site or OU? What are the substances? What's the location? Is it a special location? Which persons are affected? What type of response actions are being considered, and any other important characteristics? That's where you're starting. From there, you're then going to review and list provisions of each potential applicable requirement based on, again, the substances covered, the type of facilities involved, the people who are impacted, and the actions being considered. Once you have that list, you're going to compare the facts about your site. Remember, we had those criteria that we could look at. We're going to look about the pertinent facts of the chemicals present, location, and types of action or technology under consideration at the site. And from there, the question you'll ask, are all the pertinent provisions for requirements met? If the answer is no, then you're going to continue on to see if that requirement is relevant and appropriate. But if the answer is yes, then you can say the requirement is applicable. It's directly applicable to the remedy or alternative that's being considered. So that's how you get considering the facts that you have, what you have going on at the site, and seeing if it's like an apples to apples kind of comparison. That's where you'll get either to the yes or no as to whether a requirement is applicable. If it is not, then you still want to have that relevant and appropriate process. So, in determining if a requirement is relevant and appropriate, you're going to review factors that we're going to go through to determine if a site situation is similar enough, sufficiently similar to the problem, the site, the issue that the requirement is designed to remedy or address. So, there's a number of different factors that can be looked at listed here in detail. So, what are the goals and objective of that requirement? What's its purpose? What media does it deal with or substances does it address? Does it deal with a type of physical location, a specific activity, or a potential use? And then relating that of the requirement to the factors you have going on in your specific site or operable unit. Remember, this is where we had those eight criteria compared to each other to help determine if it was applicable, excuse me, relevant and appropriate. So you're going to consider all of that information. And then from there, excuse me, from there, you're going to make those considerations. And then if the answer is no to the question of based on consideration of factors, is the requirement both relevant and appropriate? If your answer is no, it's not, then it may be that the requirement is not relevant and appropriate, so you don't include it. However, if your citation is broad, you may want to try and subdivide the requirement into smaller parts to ensure that you're looking at each part individually and not missing something that should be included as an agar for your decision document. Again, remember I said you don't want to cite the whole Clean Water Act. You want to get it down to the specific part of that act that is, in fact, an agar to what is being done or considered for your remedy or site. And in that case, if you are going to subdivide it, you go through the whole process again to answer that question as to whether or not it's relevant and appropriate. If the answer is yes, then you know that you have another AWAR to include in your decision document. All right. So hopefully stepping through each box in that process was a little more helpful to understanding how to go about determining AWARs. But let's try to apply your understanding in this example here.
Okay, a new pop-up is opening, but this one's going to be a little different. This one's going to ask you two questions in one window. So you may need to scroll up and down to see everything depending on your screen size. Again, move that poll window around as needed to look at a complete view of the picture on the slide, but we're asking you to consider a situation where you have soil disturbing and fencing activities during the remedy implementation, which could impact the entire site. That's the yellow arrow on the left. And then in the blue portions, both on the top and bottom, we have some endangered species that were found in those areas. So we're asking two questions for this scenario. Number one, how should the Endangered Species Act be considered for this site? You'll either pick A, applicable, B, relevant and appropriate, C, TBC, or D, should not be considered. And then you'll scroll down to question two. What type of ARAR should the Endangered Species Act be identified as? Is it A, chemical specific, B, location specific, or C, action specific? So do your very best. And then once you've selected an answer for each of those two questions, hit the submit button. Looks like about 40% of you have responded. If you're having any difficulties, remember you can always type a message into the Q&A. And as I'm looking here, Emmy, it does look like we've got a pretty clear answer for two, but they're fighting it out for that first question. So we might have a little bit of a dialogue here. All right, about 70% of you have voted. So I'm going to go ahead and close this poll down in 3, 2, 1. All right, so for question number one, how should the Endangered Species Act be considered? About 45% said A, applicable, but about 40% said B, relevant and appropriate. What's the right answer for the first one?
So in this case, we were looking for A, applicable. And I could see where an argument might be made for relevant and appropriate as well, which unfortunately is the case when considering a lot of AVARs, getting down to that decision as to which it may be. But for the Endangered Species Act being considered here, initially you might say, oh, well, that's not on the site, so maybe it shouldn't be considered at all. I think most people, I didn't realize, oh, these soil disturbing and fencing activities could very much impact areas away from the site where these endangered species are living. So it was coming down to, well, is it applicable or relevant and appropriate? In this case, because there are endangered species being impacted by activities at the site, we would say that it's applicable.
All right. And the second question, what type of ARARs should the Endangered Species Act be identified as? About 70% said B, location specific.
Yes, and that's the answer we were looking for. Perfect.
Excellent.
All right, and we have one more. Apply your
We
understanding.
Okay, so get
Opportunity.
ready. We've got another two-parter. So again, a new question has popped up for this new scenario. In this case, we are looking at a pump and treat situation where we have on-site groundwater treatment, and the remedy does include direct discharge to a surface water body. So they're asking and looking in this scenario where the contaminated water is moving towards your extraction wells, being treated, and then again discharged to that surface water body, which federal regulations could be considered as an ARAR for this particular site? So your first question, which federal reg, as I just said, is that which one could be considered an ARAR? And you're going to see RCRA for option A, B, Clean Water Act, C, Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act, or D, Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. You can pick all that you think apply for that first question. And then you'll scroll down further to question number two. And in this case, we're asking which subpart of the federal regulation identified should be considered an ARAR for the site. And so from that, you're going to pick from A, Clean Water Act Indirect Discharge Requirements, B, Clean Water Act Section 404 regarding dredged materials. Is it C, Clean Water Act National Pollutant Discharge Elimination? There's your NPDES. And then D, is it the Clean Water Act Section 103, the marine protection component? So again, I'll ask you to scroll through those and then click through what you believe are the correct answers and submit. About half of you have cast your vote, and we'll go ahead and talk through the correct answers here in just a moment. Any difficulties with that, feel free to just type a message into the Q&A and share what you believe the right answer should be. I'll go ahead and close this one down here in 3, 2, 1. You guys have been great. About 70% of you having voted. So overwhelmingly, everybody picked the Clean Water Act for that first question. They all think that is a regulation that should be considered an ARAR. However, about half thought maybe C, the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act. About a third thought maybe D, Wild and Scenic Rivers Act as well. And even some spot A, RCRA. So, Emmy, what's the right answer?
So Clean Water Act was definitely one that we were looking for. And given on the limited information provided in this scenario, C and D would also be appropriate. That Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act, for the fish that are in, potentially impacted that live in that stream, and the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act may also be appropriate, but would have to be considered against the site factors. So B, C, and D all made sense.
Wonderful. All right. And then the second question, which subpart of the federal regulation identified should be considered an AWR for this site? 90% of them picked C, the Clean Water Act Serendipity's response. Is that correct?
Yes, we were looking for C on that one. So good job, everybody. All right. So let's go ahead. Oh, you know what? Before we get into points of compliance, were there any questions to we should address now, Jean?
Sure. We did have a question, I believe. This was just in reference to this particular scenario. Would they wanted to know, would RCRA be an AWR for that holding tank? So, for example, requiring double wall, secondary containment.
Potentially. Again, I hate to say maybe instead of a very clear yes or no, but yes, it would depend on how this exactly was being implemented and any other site conditions they had to factor in. So the holding tank could potentially be subject to RCRA,
Okay.
which makes me think I need to rewrite my quiz questions a
And
little bit better.
I will throw in a few other people are throwing in that the treatment train could also RCRA could apply to that treatment train as well. RCRA could be an AWR for the disposal of the treated media as well. So there's a couple of other suggestions in the Q&A. So I want to thank people for that one. I'm scrolling up here. This is just in reference to slide 45. MCLGs, the attendee states that those are not enforceable. So why would they be considered ARARs? MCLGs.
Yes, for the chemical specific ARARs that we could consider. So we definitely would consider that in looking at the protective remedy, though they're not enforceable. I would have to get back to you all as to whether that would be identified as a TBC in your table, your AWR table, or if the MCLGs would just, be included under that TBC umbrella. So I will look into that and clarify the slides. Apologies if that was confusing.
Okay. And then we have a quick clarification on permits. Somebody just wondered, permits are not ARARs, are they?
No, the permit itself is not an ARAR, but the substantive portions of that permit may be considered an ARAR based on the remedy being considered for the site. So the getting the permit and the administrative aspects of it, not an ARAR. But if, for example, with the NPDES permit that limits the concentrations of a contaminant that can be discharged to surface water, that portion most definitely would be an ARAR.
Okay.
And
And we are circling back to the MCLGs. I have a comment that G is goal, and that is not enforceable.
yeah, I'm noting in my just looking at my notes here about those goals that are set above zero. I think that's where I had a additional information. So again, I'm definitely going to look at this and make it more clear, because I do believe that these MCLGs that are set above zero are considered as ARARs for ground or surface waters that are potential sources of drinking water. Where they're appropriate for the site. So I will look into that. Thank you for pointing it out, though, so I'm better prepared to answer that in the future.
All right. I think, Emmy, what we'll do is we'll carry on with the presentation. We do have plenty of time for Q&A. I will note to the audience, if you asked a question earlier, if I haven't read it out loud, that doesn't mean I'm not coming back to it. Some things we kind of hold off until later when there's a broader time for discussion. So keep those questions coming in. We will pause again. And Emmy, I'll turn the floor back over to you.
All right, let's get into points of compliance. So for groundwater, we're looking at those POCs or points of compliance for attaining remediation levels that are going to be established on a site-specific basis. So remediation levels should be attained again throughout the contaminated plume or at the boundary of the waste management area. So different areas of the plume may reach remediation levels at different times. So if you're focusing on a hotspot in the center, or off to one edge of the plume, that may reach remediation levels be before the leading edge does, and so on. So, sorry, for groundwater, again, the key point being here is for our points of compliance, we're looking for those remediation levels to be met throughout the plume, not just at the leading edge or not just where it's gone off-site. With surface water points of compliance, we're looking at selected levels that should be attained at the point where the release enters the water, like end of pipe, essentially. So very tangible to see where that happens and making sure that the appropriate levels for contaminants are being met there. With air points of compliance, the selected level should be established for the maximum exposed individual, considering the use of the site and the surrounding area. So you might have emissions from soil excavation, air stripping, or incineration. All of those activities would need to be looked at to determine what the selected level should be, as they are established for that maximum exposed individual. And now we're going to get into CERCLA AERAR waivers. So we get a lot of questions at headquarters, EPA headquarters, about when an AERAR waiver can be invoked, how it's invoked, and there seems to be a lot of maybe misunderstanding around it. So I'm hopeful that going through these individually will help us all better understand when and where CERCLA waivers can be used, or AERAR waivers, excuse me. So again, looking back at CERCLA Section 121D, that requires that on-site remedial actions attain or waive AERARs upon completion. Any off-site activities must comply with all applicable laws and regulations. For example, if an activity is happening off-site, that is an activity that needs to be permitted, you need a permit for that activity because it's not on the CERCLA site. So, for example, if you have a staging area or a disposal area that is off-site, then the appropriate permits need to be in place for that off-site staging or disposal area. It has to apply with the administrative and substantive portions of those requirements. Also, the statutory requirements to achieve protectiveness can never be waived, right? We have our threshold criteria under CERCLA. One, that the remedy be protective, and two, that it meet or waive AERARs. So that protectiveness always has to be met in considering cleanup for our sites. Another thing to keep in mind is that a waiver must be invoked for each AERAR that will not be attained. It's not one waiver covers multiple, it's one waiver per AERAR. And I'll talk more about that in the upcoming slides. So, what's the process for getting an AERAR waiver? Or I should say the public participation requirements. So, an AERAR waiver is not something that can just be signed off by EPA. It has to go out for public comment. The proposal of an AERAR waiver should be included in a proposed plan. One second, apologies for my video. But I'll just continue on. So you need to allow the public the opportunity to comment on a proposed waiver. So that needs to be in the proposed plan that goes out for public comment that talks about the remedy being considered, the preferred alternative. The ROD then must include the waiver invoked and its justification. So if there's great opposition to a waiver that is provided through public comment, that has to be considered and addressed in the ROD's response to comments in order to justify it actually being issued. If there's huge public or a huge lack of support from the public, that might determine that a waiver is not appropriate. But there's a lot of factors that have to be considered. Here I'm just highlighting that you have to go through this proposed plan public involvement process to have a waiver considered. So there are six AERAR waivers. I'm going to talk about the first five. The sixth one is about fund balancing. So that does not apply to federal facility sites where the lead cleanup agency is responsible for funding the cleanup. But we will talk about the other five. So let's start with interim measures. But before we do that, I'd like to just check with the group and see which waivers do you have experience with at your site.
All right, I am launching What's for some of you may be thankfully our last poll. Some of you may be sad, but this is the last question that we have for you. And in this particular one, as Emmy said, we're going to ask you to identify so you can check the box to the left of any and all waivers you have experience with at your sites. So is it A, interim measures, B, greater risk to health and the environment, C, technical impracticability, D, equivalent standard of performance, E, inconsistent application of state requirements, or F, fund balancing, but this does not apply to federal facility sites. So we'll just ask you to check the box off to any and all and then submit your responses. Looks like about a quarter of you have sent in a response. Again, there is no right or wrong answer. We're just getting a sense of your own experiences with your sites. And as I wait, I'll just remind everyone you're certainly welcome to use that Q&A if it's easier to send your message in. Just as one of the participants noted that they don't have experience with any of these at their sites, that's also equally useful. So if you can't use the poll or you don't find the right response in the poll options, go ahead and just share a message with us in the Q&A. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll out here in 3, 2, 1. And Emmy, I'm going to share these results. And it looks like overwhelmingly C, technical impracticability, which is also one of my favorite words, we got about 60% of the respondents voting. And then A, interim measures. Those were the top two waivers that they had experience with. But I'm seeing a number of messages in the Q&A that they have no experience with any of them. So I think that might be another point to just acknowledge that there are some varying levels of experience with staff. So that some of these are not applicable since people are so new to this process.
Oh, right. No, thank you for that, everyone. That it is helpful to see where the experience is or is not when it comes to AWRAR waivers. So let's go ahead and go through the five different AWRAR waivers that you might consider for a federal facility site. So the first one I would say is probably the one most people are familiar with, and that's for use of an interim measure. So this waiver can apply when the remedial action selected is only part of a total remedial action that will attain such level or standard of control when completed. So the example I like to give for this is, say you have a groundwater alternative for hydraulic containment that will not attain MCLs, but this containment is an important interim measure that will become part of a total remedial action. So in an interim measure, again, some of those ARARs might not be met, but because future remedial action is considered, that can potentially be waived. The interim measures, I will say, these types of records of decision or proposed plan are not sent to EPA headquarters for review. It's generally understood, okay, this is an interim measure. You're not going to be able to meet all ARARs, but you still need to have, steps towards protectiveness of the remedy for that site. Another example I like to give is, say you have a groundwater plume. Actually, one second. Yeah, say you have a groundwater plume. And there's some really, really hot spots of contaminants. And if you focused on that hot spot of contamination, say through pump and treat or in situ treatment, you could really reduce the amount of contamination moving through the groundwater plume. So you might have an interim action that is to focus on that hot spot of contamination and reduce contaminants to 10 times the MCL. So in that case, you're not meeting the MCL, which would be an ARAR for the final decision, but it's easy to justify this is one step towards attaining that final cleanup level that we're taking in the interim. So that's another example. All right. The next waiver I want to talk about is the greater risk. So this deals with compliance with a requirement at a facility that would actually result in greater risk to human health and the environment than alternative options. In the example here, imagine that there are land disposal requirements for treating waste before placement in a landfill unit, and that those requirements would actually result in greater risk to workers. So comes from an actual site where there is an on-site landfill for CERCLA waste, and there's radiologically contaminated machinery, very large pieces of pipe and other very heavy things that have to be moved with a crane that need to go into the landfill for disposal. Well, based on the land disposal requirements, they state that you have to treat or encapsulate that waste at the surface before it's placed in the land or the cell itself. Since these were such big, heavy items with rad contamination, pausing to encapsulate it at the surface before putting it within the cell was actually a greater risk than just putting that big piece of machinery or whatever it was in the cell and encapsulating it in place, essentially. So in that case, they waived the requirement to treat the waste at the surface, allowing it to be put directly into the landfill cell, encapsulated, and then, kept there for permanent disposal. So those are not really used that much in the history of the program, but we do have some examples. Then we come to technical and practicability waivers, or TI waivers. I would definitely say these are the ones that get talked about the most when it comes to the federal facilities program. And essentially, this waiver is saying that compliance with such a requirement is technically impracticable from an engineering perspective, meaning that there are no existing nor innovative technologies that can reliably attain the AROR in question, or that attainment would be illogical or infeasible from an engineering perspective. So, very specific information there. The example given for a TI waiver would be, say, MCLs are being waived in areas of highly contaminated but inaccessible pockets of liquid waste along fractures in deep bedrock. There isn't a way to suck out that contamination and treat it, and that it's impracticable from an engineering perspective. That's a pretty straightforward example. One thing I'll say with technical impracticability that we often hear is, oh, well, it would just be too expensive to implement a remedy for this contamination. And you note that here, the compliance with the requirement isn't talking about a question of cost, it's talking about engineering. Is it possible? Is it feasible? Can it actually be done? Well, so cost still is something that has to be considered as part of the criteria in considering remedies for our sites. It is important to pursue it for the appropriate reasons. We do have EPA guidance on technical impracticability waivers, how to write a sound justification for these waivers so that it can go through first the EPA regional process with the EPA RPM and the appropriate waiver person from their office. And then that comes to EPA headquarters for additional review. So it is a very big lift to pursue a technical impracticability waiver. However, if it is appropriate for the site, then it's well worth it, but it has to be fully justified with the appropriate sampling information and proof that there is, in fact, no existing or innovative technology that could be used to address the contamination in question. All right, the next type of waiver is referred to as an equivalent standard of performance. So, this waiver would be pursued when the remedial action selected will attain a standard of performance that is equivalent to that required under the otherwise applicable standard requirement criteria through use of another method or approach. So, the requirement may say a particular design or operating standard is stipulated, but there may be an equivalent or better results that could be met from an alternative design or method of operation. The key understanding here is that the alternative approach would be just as or even more effective than the original requirement. So, an example I can think of for this one would be, for a landfill, there was a requirement that there be a 50-foot buffer between the bottom of the landfill and the water table. However, in this area of the country, the water table sits at 30 feet or less below ground surface. There's really no way you can change that. However, the argument was made that through design of the bottom of the landfill, they could provide this equivalent standard of performance to ensure that contamination did not reach groundwater. And that was the justification that was provided to pursue a waiver in that example. All right. The last AERAR waiver we're going to talk about is the inconsistent application of state requirements. So remember, earlier on, when we were talking about when state requirements might be considered an AERAR, we stated that they might be more stringent than federal requirements, but they also need to be consistently applied across the state. So, with respect to that standard requirement criteria, the state has to have consistently applied it or demonstrated the intention to consistently apply it in other similar circumstances for other remedial actions. Another, I'll say, reading in between the lines, what we're trying to say here is, for example, with our federal facility sites, is this standard being applied to all Superfund sites across the state, or is it only being applied here at this federal facility site, which is inconsistent with how it's being applied elsewhere? So that's one example of saying, well, all Superfund sites should be held to the same standards in their cleanup. Why would this standard be applicable here but not there? So again, this considers both NPL sites and non-NPL sites as far as when it application should be considered. All right. In these next slides, it's just giving some information historically about how waivers have been used in the federal facility program. Again, this is not all of the Superfund sites on the NPL, but in the federal facilities program sites on the NPL. You can see we have our federal facility AERAR waivers listed from 1992 to 2020. So in the 90s, it seems like we were doing more of these types of waivers, and then coming into the late 2010s, a little bit less so. What type of waivers were being used were technical and practicability, interim action, and then to a lesser extent, that greater risk and equivalent performance. If you are interested in, well, how does my region deal with waivers? You can see here that Region 4 has had the most, or had the most up through 2020, and Regions 5, 6, and 7 the least with one. So hopefully that information is, I find it interesting to see what has historically been done in the program. Sometimes we hear, oh, you all never give a TI waiver. Like, well, actually we do. We have when appropriate and fully justified. All right, I'm going to get through this AERAR's post rod, and then we will finish up with any final questions. So what about post rod? You've heard this. Or you may have heard this phrase of AERARs are frozen in a rod, or freezing AERARs when a rod is signed. So essentially, you go through all the work to go through the CERCLA process and get to a signed record of decision. The AERARs in there are legally enforceable, so that's what's used in determining effectiveness of the remedy moving forward, and protectiveness, I should say. So if there's any new information, like newly promulgated requirements that would be an AERAR, they must be evaluated to determine whether they are important to protectiveness for your specific remedy at the site. So to the extent that the remedy remains protective, then the original AERARs remain frozen. But if you have this new information, then the remedy may need to be modified if that new AERAR is needed to be protective. And that could be implemented through a rod amendment or an explanation of significant differences, depending on how much of a change is needed. So, for example, if there's new information about a chemical cleanup level saying that, oh, what we were originally using is outside of the risk range, the CERCLA risk range, meaning that the information you used in your record of decision is no longer protective, then we would need to reassess based on the circumstances of the site today if there is an unacceptable risk there. So you'll hear the term, oh, we have to open the rod to update the ARARs. So that's what it's referring to when there's this new information that has to be considered. Oftentimes, that new information may come about as part of a 5-year review. Part of the 5-year review specifically evaluates this type of information during the technical assessment, whether it be changes in standards identified as ARARs, newly promulgated standards, or changes in to be considered TBCs that could call into question the protectiveness of the remedy, or additional information on existing ARARs or those new standards that do not affect protectiveness. That's still information that can be considered as you're going through this process of determining, oh, do I have a remedy that's no longer protective? So, for example, say you have an excavation of soil remedy for a specific contaminant, and you remove the contaminant, dig and haul it down to 15 or 20 feet below ground surface, whatever is the appropriate depth to be protective of groundwater for your site. So, in that remedy, all of that contaminated soil was dug up and treated and disposed of appropriately. So, if there's new information saying, oh, the cleanup standard for this contaminant is now more stringent, go back and check your remedies. Well, in that case, all of that contamination was removed and disposed of appropriately. So, if there is not a change in protectiveness because the contaminant essentially is no longer present at the site, it's been removed. So, that's an example of when you wouldn't have a change in protectiveness, even though there is new information that needs to be considered. All right, so that was ARARs in a nutshell. I'm going to check with Jean and see what questions we have for the last part of our webinar today.
Okay, well, Emmy, we do have a number of questions that are in the queue. The first thing that I will just mention is that some of the bar charts, a number of the attendees have just noted that there look like there might be some typos on the graph or some information might be missing from those bar charts. So I'm just going to make that acknowledgement, thank them for their eagle eye review of the charts, and I'll take those comments and share them with you afterwards. But let's go to a question about TI waivers. One of the attendees asks, shouldn't TI waivers be revisited based on advances in technology?
Yes, absolutely. So a TI waiver, once issued, is not a permanent waiver. Any new information, be it new technologies or changes in cleanup standards, things like that, should be considered. Typically, those are considered as part of the 5-year review process, but they don't necessarily have to come through that process. They can occur at any point in time. So, absolutely agree. It's not a forever type of waiver. You still have to consider new information and make changes if that new information can be applied to the TI waiver given for a site.
If a regulation is amended or changed after a ROD, does the original regulation remain the ARAR? What if that regulation was repealed?
So in that case, you would the ARARs were frozen, right? But there's new information that this requirement has been repealed, then that is something that you would consider in your remedy. If it affects protectiveness, then you'll determine if there needs to be a change to the remedy. If it does not, then there might be no changes required.
We have a question. Has EPA ever used that inconsistent application of state requirements? Can you think of an example where this was used?
Not in the federal facilities program, but throughout the entirety of the Superfund program, I'm not sure. I'd have to check. There might be some, but I'd have to pull the information from our database.
So let's talk about specific ARARs. One of the attendees noted that you said a few times that ARARs need to be specific, but can you go too far? Can they be too specific and cause an issue?
I'm not sure if they can be too specific. As you're carving away at the requirements into those subparts, really getting down to just what is applicable or relevant and appropriate for your site.
I'm wondering if they're hinting at potential flexibilities in the language to allow for some changes in what might be happening at the site or changes in certain condition. And if they narrow it down to something so specific at this snapshot in time that then that ARR isn't really useful because it's too specific.
In that case, I would say I'm sure that could happen, but working with your attorneys, your regional counsel is very important because they should be able to help guide you through that question of what is specific enough, because you're going to have a lot of ARRs to consider. So once you get to that point of yes, this is the level of specificity we would have, you want to move on to the next one, but rely on your team, particularly your attorneys, to help answer that question.
Okay. We have a few questions about emerging contaminants. So the new contaminants, the one that they're all asking about is PFAS. So they're wondering how things like PFAS should be handled post-rod if they weren't originally identified in site investigation because they weren't known back at that time.
So this comes back to considering new information at a site. So say we have, well, we do have these new MCLs for PFAS, right? For six PFAS. And if you're looking at your sites, maybe these were not identified as contaminants of concern. But if you have this new information that indicates your site may have the presence of these contaminants, then the question is, are you looking at your remedy to amend it or change it in some fashion if it's not protective? Or does a new remedy have to be issued to address this PFAS contamination? So it's going to be very site specific on how this is approached. I would say PFAS, like any other emerging contaminant before it was 1,4-dioxane for years and years, are treated the same way. It's not a different process or wholly new process. It is the same CERCLA process that considers new information, determines if there's an unacceptable risk. If so, then determines a way to move forward with implementing an appropriate remedy.
Okay. All right. We have a number of questions. I just want to acknowledge them in the queue that are very scenario or site specific. So sometimes when we get into those questions where a lot of variables are laid out and what's your assessment in this situation? Would this apply? Would it not? I'll just say those questions are great, but sometimes we can't get into them on a webinar. So the site-specific questions that are coming in, I might not be able to take them live, but Emmy and I will talk about follow-up questions and where to go if you do have a more site-specific question where you might want to engage offline with someone to get a response. So I do want to see, I want to acknowledge that those have come in there and just let you know we might not be able to get to some of those site-specific ones, but there are some that I can take right now. And I'm just going to go back to this one. Why are specific threshold values not listed in those ARRs table?
Specific, well, you in your record of decision will have cleanup levels specific to your site and the remedy being implemented. But in your ARRs table, ARRs are going to apply to different sites, and the values therein would be different depending on your site circumstances. So we use the cleanup levels identified in the remedy description in the record of decision to identify what those values are, but they're not typically included in the ARRs tables.
Okay. Are state licensing requirements for some of the professional staff, like geologists, engineers, are those ever considered ARRs?
I don't believe so. I'm hesitant to say no, never, but I don't believe those are typically considered ARRs.
Okay. Are there instances where there may be misalignment between your federal facility partners, for example, a state requirement that doesn't align with a federal requirement?
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time, Jean?
Are there instances where there may be misalignment between an FFA partner, for example, a state requirement that does not align with a federal requirement?
Yes, I think that happens a lot, and that's part of why it's so important for the FFA parties, the state EPA and the lead cleanup agency to talk early and often about what ARs will look like, particularly if there is a gap between what one regulatory agency is considering versus another. So it can be determined, is this state requirement in fact an ARAR that needs to be considered because it's promulgated and more stringent than a federal standard, or not? Or is it an administrative type requirement, in which case it would not be considered an ARAR? So those conversations are important to have as early as possible to work through them as you refine your ARARs tables throughout the process.
Okay. All right. We had a couple of just comments that were in response to some other statements that were made, and I'll just read through some of these. One of the attendees noted that MCLGs and water quality criteria are the two non-promulgated items that are discussed and included in the NCP preamble. So there are cases where these things are specifically stated. So I wanted to thank that attendee for sharing that. We also had another participant say that, in getting back to some of those risk-based values that states may be using and the role that they play in this process, one of the attendees noted that we've seen states insist that the risk-based values constitute ARARs and would then stand in for EPA's flexible risk range during their risk assessment process. And they want to do that well before the feasibility study. And they go on to say, we understand that this would be misplaced. ARARs do not inform your risk assessment. And they just wanted to share that and clarify. Would you say that that's accurate, Emmy, that the ARARs should not be informing that risk assessment? So if states are
Oh.
pushing to use these risk-based standards as an ARAR, that's not okay.
I would say that that becomes complicated very quickly because
Okay.
there may be requirements for how that risk is considered, or I should say calculated, and why I could see the argument being made for why that's important to include in the risk assessment. When it comes to conducting risk assessments, you want to make sure that you are following EPA guidance on that topic, and also that your risk assessors are, that you're relying on your risk assessors to have those conversations as to what is and what is not appropriate. So it's not a black and white type of answer, as none of these answers really are. But it seems like it's something that has to be worked through. But I wouldn't assume, oh, the state's approach is the only way, or EPA's approach is this specific approach is the only way. It really seems like it needs to be a collaborative effort between the parties to discuss.
Okay. All right. We've had people asking if you can provide a resource to identify executive orders. Statutes and regulations are readily available, but those EOs can be tricky to locate and consider in their ARARs analysis. Do you have any recommendations?
I do not. I myself
Okay.
am unaware of a database or a single location for those executive orders.
Okay.
But I will, as far as federal facilities go, look at whether or not we can help on our public-facing website provide a list of those or links to those
Okay.
to try and help with the situation because, yes, it is challenging when they don't all live in one spot where you can
Yeah.
reference them.
Yeah. And I think a related question here is there a comprehensive list of potential federal and state ARARs that can be consulted to assist in the quote review and list provisions of each potential applicable requirement step? So I think you're kind of.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice? I will say in our federal facility agreements, typically those documents do have a section that list ARARs that should be considered for remedies at that site. We also have the 2017 guidance. It's not specific to federal facilities, but it talks about how EPA can work with state partners to identify ARARs in a more effective fashion. I don't think it has a list of ARARs quite as being requested, but it does have a lot of good information on how to go about determining what those should be.
All right, Emmy, I think just in the interest of time, again, we do have some of these site-specific questions. What do we do if the state won't do this? What will we do if the DoD won't do this? So I just want to acknowledge a lot of these site-specific ones. We're going to give you an answer to this later. But Emmy, there are a few people asking for definitions of things like on-site or off-site. And I think this might be a fantastic way to tee up a reminder about the other webinars in the series.
Yes.
So,
Determining land use and on-site, off-site. requirements is one of the webinars we offer because that question does come up a lot. I believe we have this year's version of that webinar archived already, Jean.
We do, we do.
So it's available for folks to go ahead and check out if you're dealing with that question on your site. When it comes to on-site or off-site, what I will say quickly is that when it comes to groundwater, there's an expectation that the contaminated plume will be followed, even if it goes beyond a fence boundary. So that's where some of the confusion of off-site versus on-site occurs. When it comes to activities at the surface, where it's a little more, clear what is on-site or off-site, anything that's off-site as far as disposal activities, groundwater treatment or reinjection has the requirement for a permit versus on-site, that requirement is waived. But check
Okay.
out the other webinar if you have more questions.
All right. So, Emmy, why don't we go through your final reminders and then I will come back on the line to remind them how they can get to the other webinars, get credit, access the ones that are coming up before we close out today.
Sure. So one before we go to that, again, thank you to the person who identified that information regarding NCLGs and NCLs being part of the Safe Drinking Water Act. I was also looking for some information where it states that non-zero NCLGs and if none NCLs promulgated under the Safe Drinking Water Act generally will be relevant and appropriate standards for groundwater that is used for drinking. So yes, that's why we have that on the slide, but I'm going to add some information so that's clear for future webinars. Lastly, remember you can complete all 11 webinars and our in-person 3-day class to receive a certificate of completion, which is signed by our director of the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office. Great way to show your management that you're putting in that extra work to understand Superfund and implement it consistently across our sites. And again, thank you for joining us today. And I will leave it with Jean to close us out. Thank you so much, everyone.
All right. Thank you so much, Emmy. I'm going to take over here and walk the audience through just a few final reminders before we close things out today. So I'm going to swap the view from our presentation materials and let's talk about the overall seminar series. So for anyone who wasn't on at the very beginning, if you've kind of come in mid-seminar or mid-series, the ongoing Federal Facilities Academy includes 11 online webinars that we are hosting through the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org, which are open to the public. And there is a single classroom delivery, which is open to a limited audience. Now, you may participate in any or all of those 11 online webinars, either by taking them live or by replaying the recorded versions. So each session will be publicly archived. You can do them all live. You can do them some online, some live. You can do them all replaying the recording. You can mix and match as needed. And then if you are part of the target audience for that in-person classroom training, if you are an EPA, state, tribal, or other federal regulator, you are eligible to register to participate in the in-person training opportunity. That is only available to you in person. So if you take all of the webinars and you attend that in-person training, you can receive an Academy certificate that acknowledges that you participated in the entire series. However, if you are not eligible to take that in-person classroom training or simply can't, you can still document and get credits or certificates for each of those 11 webinars. I'm going to explain how you can access that for today's session, but essentially for each webinar, whether you take it live or replay the recorded version, you simply need to submit a feedback form, checking a box on that form that you indicate you were here for the entire delivery or replayed the entire archive. And then when you submit it, we'll give you a certificate that you can download or save for your own records. All right, so walking through that ongoing series, we are right here in our May delivery. So we have already hosted three sessions. The previous three topics on land use and on-site, off-site determinations, community involvement, and military munitions, those have already been publicly archived on the Cleanup Information Network. And then if you are interested in registering for the other sessions that are upcoming, you can head over to TrainX, to the Federal Facility Academy page, where we list and have links to register to all of them. If you're more familiar with the CLUIN training calendar, we also have all of the public webinars listed there. So again, I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network, and please be sure to sign up for that free monthly newsletter that I send out on the first of each month, Tech Direct, where we'll highlight training opportunities like today's webinar. Today's specific seminar in the series does have its own unique seminar homepage. It's the same place you went when registering. It's the same place you went to check in. It is the same place I will send you in my reminder and follow-up emails for your feedback. The URL is shown in red on this slide. That website will remain active. This is a screenshot of another webinar in the series, but the structure is the same. So I'll just point out that we have a whole series of sections. You may need to scroll up and down to find the section of interest. You can also use these little plus and minus icons to collapse and expand. But we do have copies of the presentation materials in a file that's called the Participant Manual. The Participant Manual contains not only the slides, but subsequent notes and links all in one PDF file. So if you'd like the materials for today's session, head over to this website and look on that webinar slide section for the Participant Manual. And we do have related resources as well linked here. The seminar feedback form is available from the seminar homepage. And when you fill out that feedback form, there is a box that you can check at the bottom of the form, letting us know that you were here for the entire live delivery. And then as soon as you submit it, you'll have access to a certificate of participation, something like the one shown on the screen, that you can either download or print out from your own records. I'll also email a copy to you, but those sometimes get caught up in junk or spam filters. So I encourage you to download it from the pop-up that you'll see on the confirmation screen. Again, you can submit this feedback form based on your live attendance or based on replaying any one of our webinars. Now, if you happen to be one of the lucky people who joined a viewing party at your location, meaning that one person registered and then several of you joined together from a conference room, I simply ask that the individual who registered, please make sure you send them the link to the seminar homepage, and then everyone who joined from your location can fill out that feedback form, get their own certificate of participation, even though they didn't register on their own. And please do share your thoughts. I really do read each and every one of those submissions, and they help us to continue to offer free online technical training. Again, today's session was recorded just like the others in the series. You'll get an automatic email as soon as that archive is available for on-demand playback. And I encourage you to share that with other colleagues. So with that, I want to thank Emmy, who took time out of her very busy day to share her expertise with us. And I want to thank the over 170 individuals who joined us for today's live session. We hope that this was a valuable experience for you and you will join us on future deliveries. With that, I'll formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.